Okay, so it's about time to get started again. So one of the things that people who watch the series on Twitch know that oftentimes in the Twitch chat or even on the stream, data-oriented programming or other terms like this come up, and pretty much universally what everyone mentions and what I mention on the stream is go watch the CPPCon keynote by Mike Acton, go check it out, like it's a fantastic lecture. And it's like it's just the perfect thing to point people to as an introduction to sort of the same sorts of stuff that we always talk about, and given by somebody with a lot of credibility in the industry as well is pretty great. And so when I was putting together who I wanted to come talk to you today, I was like, well, I don't know Mike Acton, I never met him, but I was like, I'm just going to send him an email and see if he wants to come, because I know that everyone would love to hear what he had to say, and he was able to make it. So thank you very much for coming, and we're going to talk to him. I guess he was making notes during Tommy's talk, so he actually has some stuff that he wants to talk about separate from my list, so this should be pretty good. So please join me in welcoming Mike Acton. So, Mike,
I do have to say this is an entirely different reaction than I got from the C++ program.
What can you do? Before, you know, I'm interested to know what's on the list, but before I ask about that, I just wanted to say quickly, for people who don't know very much, like for people who aren't in the game industry, for example, obviously you do the technical direction at Insomniac. Yeah. Tell them just a little bit about what that actually is, because there's probably people who've never worked at a game company before. Those people would not even know what that necessarily means. So,
okay, so we have an engine team, and you know, in the AAA space, I'd say we're about we're at the low end of size in the AAA space. So our engine team is about 20 people.
20 people.
And that includes the our engine support people, which we have two people who are not programmers on the team, basically doing testing and other organization stuff for the team. And so, yeah, it's the engine team, and we do not just the engine runtime, but also the tools and supporting all the current games that we're working on, which tends to be somewhere between 3 and 6 active games in the studio.
That's a lot for 22 people.
Sure. I mean, we do all that engine and tool support and chase around the studio. I mean, the rest of production, which is another roughly 190 people, are divided into their various productions and shared, you know, groups and things. And so, yeah, we're running around supporting all the games in development and working on the engine and active forward features and whatever, you know, the current fire and problem is, and whatever the current demo is, and whatever the current thing that the publisher wants and that we want to, you know, to show off in terms of our vision of the game and tech. It's a lot of stuff, and I think, you know, there's that, you know, we are, like I said, sort of the small end of AAA, but you know, that means that it's very rapid. Like, you really have to be moving fast, and there's no room for slop at our scale, right? When you have a bunch of games in development and a team, you know, of this size, and you have to support everybody, and you still have to make forward progress on an engine, and you have to make all the tools and everything, everybody's moving all the time.
And so what's your role in that?
So my role is the director of the team, which is, you know, largely to work with the team and work with the leads on the team and organize and make sure that we, you know, I like to tell the team that your job is what you make it. And I think that's true of just about anybody, right? You figure out what your best way to contribute is. And for me, you know, as a director, that's really sort of sitting down with everybody. Sometimes it's architectural review and saying, you know, what is it that you are doing and how do we approach it and is there a better way or is there, you know, can I just ask the right questions to sort of cut off this, you know, a path that's going to waste a bunch of time. Or is it sort of low-level review? I'm just looking at some code and doing that. Or is it, it's actually valuable for me to sit down and write something here, right?
Okay, so sometimes you'll actually jump in and do something if that's, like, really critical at that point or
something. Yeah, I mean, it happens sometimes. It, you know, usually, though, that's not the highest value thing I can be doing, right? I want my job as much as possible to be multiplied by, you know, what everybody is doing. So as much as possible, I need to be, you know, making everybody else better and spending time figuring out how to help them become better programmers. And that's really where, or better leads or whatever it is, right? And that's really where the value comes in for what I do.
So, like, you know, obviously, I think most people have probably seen the CppCon lecture and the sort of stuff you talked about focusing on, you know, what the actual problem is and the data and transformation and the hardware, all of these things. Do you find that at, you know, at your scale, which is, you know, 20 or so programmers who are working on, you know, engine, console engine stuff, do you get a lot of, are most of the people on that team of the same opinion as you about those things, or is that like, is there some degree of tension among people about, like, a lot of people want a lot of object-oriented stuff or this sort of thing? Like how does that look on your team? Because I don't really know, because you're essentially a person with a very specific opinion about that, and what does the rest of the team look like?
I would say, well, I mean, to be fair, everybody looks moderate by comparison to me.
Okay.
So that's true as well, I think, on our engine team, right? And the further away I think you get from the engine team, the more that's true.
Okay.
You know, when you get to the sort of the gameplay team, they're going to be less in that space.
Okay.
But I think even among the engine team, though, I mean, I think we're all about the same kind of fundamental principles, right? We're all about understanding what it is that we're doing. And it's really the small things that are difference. And it's about, you know, it's how much we compromise that's a difference. So there's no fundamental argument. There's certainly no one on the team that's saying, you know what we really need here is more abstraction.
Okay.
What we really need here is to spend some time making UML diagrams.
Okay.
There's no one on
that
the team
that is not said.
That's
meeting
doing
does
that,
not
right?
happen.
So yeah, it's a matter of scale, right? It's a matter of, you know, how much is too much, and you know, how much is it? You know, where is something else really more valuable to spend time on? So I think maybe as a team we look extreme as a whole compared to
other
teams.
So you're extreme in an extreme team,
so,
in some sense.
Yeah, okay. to some degree. But I think, everybody is, you know, really wants to understand what, you know, not just their data, but what it is that they're doing and fundamentally solve, be rational about how they solve problems. So within that space, if you're working with smart people who want to be rational, it's hard to go wrong, really. So,
like, one of the questions I wanted to ask, because it's something that I get asked a lot of times, and I'm not really in a position to answer on the show, is a lot of people worry or have the understanding that a lot of the things that have to do with maybe, like, object-oriented programming or other, the kinds of programming that you were explicitly saying aren't very helpful, like in the CppCon thing, that those are necessary for larger scale, look, they have this opinion that, yeah, okay, if they start to believe that focused problem solving kinds of programming works for one person, they don't believe it would work for 20 people. And somehow the, like, object orientedness is necessary, or it comes as part of this attempt to make the programming scale up to larger teams. And so as someone who is actually, you know, in charge of making sure that such a team runs smoothly, would you say that's accurate, inaccurate? What are your thoughts on that kind of a comment or question?
Right, so here's the problem with the question.
Perfect.
Which is that you can't defend the question.
Okay.
Right, you're giving me a secondhand question.
Certainly, yes.
Right,
yes.
So, you know, what I would be asking whoever was asking the question was, you know, from where do you get this viewpoint?
Yes, right.
You know, is it because somebody told you?
Yeah.
Is it because this is your actual experience that, you know, you've been working in space for this long? But, you know, I mean, basically the answer is no, that's complete bullshit.
Okay.
It makes no sense. Like, that's why you would want to get to the heart of the question, because the question doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
There's no evidence to support, none, zero evidence to support that. In fact, I think, you know, if we just did a search of the most successful, you know, the libraries, for instance, that have survived the longest or have been the most successful, you probably wouldn't find a deep object hierarchy in them, right?
Okay.
You would find sort of simple, you know, interfaces. You know, you might, they might have their own problems, but, you know, this, you know, the simple, you know, input output interfaces are going to certainly last, you know, the test of time and be complicated and support. I mean, how many projects have used, say, libc or libm?
Right.
You know, those projects, that's a large, fairly large scale, right? Yeah. And then lots of projects have used them. And you know, and to be honest, I think that the real answer to that is it's actually counterproductive to scaling to a large project. You know, if we look at deep object hierarchies and that kind of design, you know, and I'm sort of imagining in my head what that design looks like. what happens is you're hiding so much valuable information and you're creating so much not valuable information, sort of adding to the problem, right? That you're making the problem more complicated than it is. And when you have a bunch of people, 100 people, you know, 1,000 people, all making the problem more complicated than it actually is, it's orders of magnitude, ultimately, of just bullshit that you have to get through to get to the, what you actually need to do.
Yes.
More bullshit, right? And that, I think, is problematic. Like, it's actually going to be more brittle and harder to understand and more difficult to change and more difficult to test. And pretty much any measure that you would want, it's going to be poorer performing than the equivalent, you know. And you don't even know that it's equivalent sort of data-oriented model, but just the equivalent simpler model, right?
Right, just reduce the level of that abstraction as much as you could have instead of thinking that you were adding some benefit by making things more removed.
Right, I think and this is the thing that I disagree with a lot of people on, is that adding stuff to the problem does not make the problem simpler. It never makes the problem simpler. Adding something always makes it more complicated. So you want to find the absolute minimum amount that describes the solution that you're dealing with, or even the problem, right? This is the minimum set. This is the minimum thing, and that's what your solution is, right? That's what you're dealing with. As soon as you start adding, even just adding small models that are in your head, like I'm thinking of the problem in this way, that's something that you're now adding to the problem space. And now somebody else is going to come and read it, and they have to reinterpret this model that you had in your head on top of what the actual problem is. And that's going to cause confusion, and it's going to, you know. And this is why, you know, this is why they say one of the difficult problems in programming is naming. Because by naming something, you are introducing
a preconceived notion.
Yeah, you are introducing problem space. So you're introducing your mental model to the space that just doesn't exist there. To that point, I did have one of my notes from Tommy's talk, where he, Tommy, where are you? Yeah, sorry, you were first, sorry, so you're just gonna have to live with it. You said that, you know, you're talking about the physics stuff that you were doing, or the controls, actually, you're talking about the controls. And you were saying, you know, you have this sort of garbage formula. This is your word, right? Garbage formula, garbage data. And that that didn't make any physical sense, right? That was also your quote. Now, so here's the problem I have with that language of that, is that I think that, you know, the preconceived idea that the physical model, that trying to apply sort of a real world model to this, that's better, is a problem. It's not better. In fact, you've demonstrated through your game that's not better, right? That you've picked a model that is better for your game based on your testing, based on that 3 months of hard work, based on, you know, having a very clear input and output, right? The input is the controls, right? Your physical input. The output is Tommy smiles, right? This is very clear input-output scenario, right? The answer to that is the stuff that you came up with, right? Is that it's not garbage, it is the right answer. It works, right? It's the appropriate response. The way you did it, sort of testing it and iterating on it, and it doesn't matter that there's not a name, you know, you had to create a name for, you know, twisting physical whatever in the air, you know, it doesn't matter that it's not real. Right? It doesn't matter that it doesn't fit the model. I think you probably lost time by thinking that it should have fit the model. And I think coming back and now even reflecting on it and still using the word, say, garbage when you're referring to it, sets the wrong message. It's in fact the opposite. It's exactly the right thing. Garbage would have been trying to make it real, right? Because it wouldn't have been fun.
That kind of gets at an interesting mentality there that's true for a lot of stuff, which is just there's a notion of that there is some proper programming, elegance, something, blah, blah, blah. And then if you're not doing that, you kind of have to couch your statement about what you did. Like, if you're not using a real physics engine simulating all of this stuff or whatever, you have to call it a garbage formula so that people don't say, oh, you don't know how to program, you're just doing these like hacky formulas or something. But kind of sounds like what you're saying is like, no. Like, the problem is to make this thing do what it's supposed to do, and whatever is the correct solution to that is the best programming you could have done, basically.
Yes, if it's the simplest solution that solves exactly the problem that I had.
Yeah,
that's the right answer.
Yeah.
Anything else is fucked up. Yeah. Like, why would I do anything else? That whole idea that there's a solution in the ether.
Yeah.
Without context, without understanding the problem, that must be the right solution to this problem, is such complete nonsense. Like, there's no other space that I can think of that's like that. That's just complete and utter nonsense. So why we think that that's even a thing is unfathomable to me. But it is, and we know it is, and people do bring that kind of stuff all the time.
Okay, so did you want to? So, I'm kind of
leaning over my list here.
Let me see.
Which is
so
totally
I asked you some of the. Let's see what's on your list first, because if you had something you wanted to talk about, I should not interrupt. So
okay.
you tell me.
Okay, my list is totally random. Just stuff that you're talking, Tommy, just sort of like occurred to me.
What I need to do is get you and Tommy up here to talk, and then I can go to lunch.
So. You mentioned that you couldn't lock down controls early, which sort of locked down the level design. You designed the levels around it. And I think this is a really super important takeaway for everybody. This is not a lesson to ignore. Another example of a similar kind of thing, which is you're working on, an open world game, which is much more common nowadays, right? And we're working on Sunset, and Sunset's an open world game. And one of the things that many people don't realize that is sort of a fundamental function, everything is a fundamental function of, like this one piece of information is critical to designing everything in the game, and that's movement speed, especially in an open world game. Because when we're talking about an open world game, we're talking about physics. I mean, real world physics. Like, we're streaming off of a disk, ultimately. It's not, everything's not a memory. Yeah. It's got to come from a disk, and that disk has real speed.
Yeah.
And it's actually moving around.
Right, So when you say real world physics, you don't mean simulated physics, you mean the actual physics of the world spinning the disk.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's physical, and everything ultimately comes down to physics, right? I mean, there's ultimately, this is the reason why memory is the way it is, not speed. But this is a more human relatable physical problem.
Yeah.
Like, there's a spinning thing. And so, getting the data off that disk is a real issue, right? And even under the best scenario, the best circumstances is really, say, a console space, where the console manufacturers just bought the shittiest hardware on the planet, right? But at least you know that, right? Like, there is a baseline there that you can work with, unlike the PC, where... There's probably a whole barrel that they missed that's below that somebody who buying a PC could find.
Right.
So you have to work with that, right? And you have to know that this is basically the expected seek speed that you can potentially get off this drive, and this is the absolute what you could statistically guess you could get off of these drives in terms of bandwidth. So there's a sort of baseline information that you absolutely have to make any decisions at all. And then you have movement speed, right?
Yeah.
So you're moving around, and that's determining sort of what you're loading in, which is determining how much...
How fast can you get from here to here how much time I have to stream in whatever's there.
Right.
Yeah.
Which will ultimately determine your budgets, right? If I'm moving faster, my budgets get smaller because I can load less.
Very good
point, assuming you have your world divided up in some kind of tile, right? And so, you say your movement speed is, say, it's like 50 meters a second. That's a completely different game than if it's, say, 10 meters a second. Because now your world, your sort of tile budget is significantly different between those two things, right? Radically different.
Yeah.
How you design the world, how much you can load, And, you know, all of that is just these radical differences between those two choices based on this one variable.
That's pretty interesting, too, because that sort of is, especially if you're talking about a large team, that basically affects almost everybody who's working.
Yes.
The artists have to know this because they need to know how detailed to make their stuff, what it will look like, you know, especially if there's lotting that happens or something like this, you know, what can I reasonably expect to have seen? It affects the programming team because they have to think about, like, okay, what are we, you know, how are we going to design this for balancing the thing and everything? So that, right. That really, that one number, I guess, could pretty much change literally everyone's job in the company depending on where you set it.
Sure. So let's say you started, I mean, we can go one of two ways. You say you started out slow, right? You say, I'm just making up numbers here. Let's say you started up 10 meters a second, and you're going through, you do a year of development, and all of a sudden, you know, through iteration and everything, the programmer says, no, well, you know what? 50 meters a second, that's fun.
Okay.
Okay. So now you have to go back and basically toss all the level work that you've done, redo everything. In a year, and if you have 50 people or 100 people or 200 people, or if you're Ubisoft and you have like 5,000 people all working on levels, right? You're potentially throwing like millions and millions of dollars,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To say start over, and maybe that's worth it.
Yeah.
Probably it's not.
Okay.
You know, and that's just because, you know, if you're moving that much faster, your budgets have to be that much smaller, right?
Right.
Or if it's the other way, right? Let's say it's the other way. You start out 50 and you go a year of development and you say, you know what, really? We're not getting much out of that. We can slow this way down,
yeah.
And we can comfortably just like maybe have more detailed environments, but at the same time, now you have the opposite problem, right? You've done all this work and hasn't taken advantage of now this extra buffer.
Right.
And it's
so
not
your game
look
may anymore. Look kind of lousy by comparison to somebody,
right.
Because you could have put all this detail in there and instead it's very spare because it had to fit some streaming budget for like basically a racing game at this point, whereas you're a walk around, look at
right.
this game.
So, the lesson isn't really about locking down the controls or about the movement speed. It's about, you know, figuring out what these sort of keystone variables are in your game or in whatever, you know, the problem space that you're dealing with is. Because, you know, if you ignore them, if you don't understand what they are, and they're always there, and if you don't know what these keystones are, what's going to happen is you're just going to fuck yourself.
Okay.
Because if you didn't pay attention to that, right, you're
yeah.
just going to assume that I can just load the level. You're just going to assume that
yeah.
it's going to work out. And then you're going to say, well, I can just optimize at the end, which
yeah.
is the worst. You know, anytime I hear that, I just want to slap somebody. you know, you're going to get to the end.
Do you want to slap that person, or just is there just like a person you have who's paid to be like slapped?
No, I think there's a chain of people.
Okay.
By the time it gets to that, you know, that one person saying, there must have been a chain
okay.
behind them of
okay.
people that need right. to be slapped.
So it's yep. a big long slap, like
yeah.
like a running slap.
Yeah, I'm just imagining that right now. sort of fun. So yeah, I mean, understanding what those keystone variables are is critical to doing your job properly. Otherwise, you're just going to end up with sort of garbage, and you may or may not be able to make it work and ship it. But it's either going to be really poor, or it's not going to take advantage of what, you know, what it could have had. And if it's not taking advantage of it, then, you know, it's doing a disservice to your players, ultimately.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's unprofessional.
So is that something that you sort of do organically, I guess, or is that something that's actually more, a little more, I don't want to say formal, but like, do you actually sit down when like you're working on a project at the early end and, you know, come back to the design team and go, look, these, you know, looking at the way we're sort of talking about this game, these are the very critical factors that you guys need to nail down, like, now, because you can't be, you know, changing this or that, or is it not, like, you know, how does that actually play out for you when you're actually doing something like Sunset Overdrive, let's say?
So yes, I think there are some, you know, when we can identify them and is, you know, basically as soon as we can identify them and we say there is a massive knock-on effect to making this decision,
okay.
Then yes, we absolutely bring that to everybody who would listen.
Okay.
Everybody has to just shut me up about it, basically.
Okay.
Because
okay.
yes, this is absolutely critical and must be decided, or you have to understand the cost of changing your mind.
Of what's going to happen. Yeah.
Which is sometimes happens. Sometimes they say, I understand the cost of changing my mind.
But,
accept that cost,
okay.
But I still don't know the answer, so we have to move forward.
Okay.
Okay, fine. That's just the way it is.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, absolutely, you want to identify those and make it as loud as possible. And you know what? People don't want to hear it. People don't want to hear that.
I'm sure they don't.
I have to make this decision now, and you just have to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Sorry, doesn't matter if you don't want to do it. or, you know, so yeah. Right. Yes, that's the answer.
Makes perfect sense. Was there another thing on the list?
Like I have more things on the list, yes.
Okay. Well, so I think I can fit the thing I was going to ask. We've got till, 12:50 is an hour, so we've got still got plenty of time left. So why don't you do a couple more on there, because the other things I have to ask I think will fit relatively easily.
You have to ask.
I have to. There's a couple things I'm like, I gotta ask these.
All right.
I gotta ask these.
So exporting cinematics. Right. So Tommy mentioned exporting cinematics. As a problem on Super Meat Boy, it's a time-consuming iteration thing, right? So I would like to share that exporting cinematics as a problem does not go away at any scale. And in fact, well, I mean, Ron, who is, I guess, the inventor of the cinematic for the most part, could probably attest to this being true from the very beginning. So you can ask him that.
I'll add it at the very beginning.
So, you know, we were looking at sort of cinematics in Sunset Overdrive. And all of our cinematics are real time, so you'd expect that would in fact not be a problem. But real time or not, there is a large animation and a lot of hand-done work that the animator is doing in Maya, in our case.
And when you're saying cutscene here, in this case, nowadays it's an in-engine kind of a
it's
thing.
It's an engine. It's all real time.
So it's all real time. Yeah. So it's not pre-rendered, but it is actually
pre-designed.
Right, and the camera's here, and this and that.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's somebody by hand. Like, we have a cinematics tool that lets them lay out tracks and do all the things and set up per frame and. You know, and you have a music track that everything has to be synchronized to the music track in some cases, and all. You have like the opening cinematic in Sunset Overdrive had 90 shots.
Okay.
So it's a very complicated cinematic, right? And you have to still deal with all the fact that it's the game and it's all the real time things, and you still have to deal with texture streaming and all the things that happen. And
90 shots in the opening cutscene.
Yeah,
that's a lot of shots.
So it's a time consuming process to build, but it's also a time consuming process to export, which we have, which was not a real limit and were not a real problem until we got to cinematics of the scope. And when you really, this is when you really see the limits of the work that you're doing. Use Collada as our export format.
Okay.
You can say what you want about Collada, which is, you can start with saying it's not a great format. Yeah, I totally agree with you.
Is it like compressed text?
Compressed would be a stretch.
So is it like, text?
It is text.
Okay.
It's XML.
All right. All right.
It's, that's about all we don't really have to get into anything.
Fair enough, keep going.
So the point of Collada is it's an interchange format, right? It is supposed to be an interchange format, of which at the point at which it was designed, there was no successful interchange format.
Right.
Other than OBJ, which is not sufficient. Since then we now have unofficially anyway, FBX, right? And that's somewhat more compatible with more stuff, mostly because Autodesk owns everybody.
Right, once you own everybody, you can kind of just say, everyone has to read this file format.
Yeah, so that's largely the reason why FBX is successful.
Okay.
So anyway, we used Collada, and it turns out, at least using the exporter that we had at the time, that exporting the shot, a cinematic of the scope from Maya and the at least just the animation stuff, not even including all our sort of real-time tracks. This is just the straight-out animation stuff.
Right, just the source input data for
just
the cutscene.
Exporting from Maya, just like save this file, was something like 30 minutes.
Wow.
Just save the file.
So you haven't exported it, or that is the export? Are you talking about just saving the MB?
Saving the Collada file.
Okay, saving the Collada file.
Right,
I thought you meant saving the MB
export
file. I'm like,
this is not including all our stuff or or setting up the cinematic.
All right, so exporting the Collada file, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was brutal.
So you can afford to export the stuff from Maya like 16 times a day tops or something like this before it actually runs out the workday.
So you have to start making your next change before the previous one is even exported. That was brutal, and that's something that we have since tried to work around. And we have looked into obviously writing a better exporter for Collada, and, you know, looking at alternatives to Collada ultimately. But, you know, I think for now we'll probably stick with it.
So it's kind of on your radar, but it has not been solved? Like, it's still like,
well,
hey guys,
I think
30 minutes.
We have enough in terms of workarounds of the problem.
Okay.
So that it's not, yeah, it's not on my radar immediately. Like, we can work around it, and we can make it so that it's not, like, the animators can make it so it's not 30-minute export, for instance, by just not having one giant one.
Okay,
like,
right. So they just break it up into pieces, and then they can pull them in, because you said you have a separate tool.
We have
tool,
a Cinemax tool, and they can reel it together. So it's workaroundable. Yeah. It's not ideal, but it's workaroundable. And so, yeah. But it's, cinematics remains a problem. Will always remain a problem. Like, there's always something. So I just wanted to share that. Exporting cinematics is
from
a
Meat
pain
Boy
we
to
all,
sunset
we all share. So let's see. I can't read my own note.
I'm guessing I probably won't be any better.
I'll just skip to the next one then. You were talking a lot about SWF reader.
Importing,
right. I don't have any Swift stories, but it reminded me of two things. One is, in terms of, you know, you said you just sort of sat down and read the fucking manual. Like, great, you know, and everybody clapped. Yay, everybody read the manual. So yes, first of all, read the manual. I mean, looking at your, you know, whatever CPU you're using, you know, most people here, okay, he was either not using an x86 x64 base or ARM based CPU in this room.
That's gonna be nobody, right?
Okay.
Oh, there's one non-X64, non-ARM.
Okay, so that would be, so to cover all of you except that one guy right there, you could read, you know, between AMD's manuals, Intel's manuals, and the ARM manuals, you know, every single one of you should have already read these manuals, right? And I suspect.
You're talking about the Intel architecture guide.
Yeah, you know, or AMD's documentation. But yeah, the Intel books for sure.
Yeah.
Or the ARM manuals, right? But here's the thing, without putting you all on the spot, I'm pretty confident that 100% of you have not, in fact, read those manuals. And that's kind of shitty, right? That's, you're spending the most of your time on these architectures, you're spending most of your, you know, and you're gonna probably spend a long time on them, right? You're certainly gonna spend more than a few months. And so it's worth it. If you're spending more than a few months on a piece of architecture, it's worth it. And this is, you know, and I come from a console background, and you know what, we, you know, every few years or every 5 years or whatever, they just throw away the shit that we've done and give us something completely different.
Yeah.
It's still worth reading the manual, even though we know they're going to throw it away, right? So just, you know, definitely do that. I mean, take the lesson, and the fact that you all clapped is indicative that you think it's a good idea. So just go home and do that. I also, you know, when
so
I...
So wait, basically you're equating reading the SWF spec to write an importer with writing, you know, if you're going to write code in this architecture, read the actual architecture and know what it is.
Yeah. I mean, you should know...
I agree, obviously.
There's information there that you could find useful that is canonical.
Yeah.
You start there, right? Basic, you know, don't assume, right?
Yeah.
I'd also, there's other, you know... It also reminded me of the IFF format document, which I think is a classic.
You mean like the IFF document from Electronic Arts, the original one?
Yeah.
Okay, so just for people who aren't as old as we are, tell them what that is. Most people probably don't know what IFF is.
IFF is a format, really, really simple format that breaks things into blocks and has basically a header definition that says size and type, right?
It was for Electronic Arts back in, I don't know when they introduced it, probably 1982
or something,
yeah,
something like that. So it's like a 4-byte type, I think, and a 4-byte size.
Yeah. And they're usually ASCII.
No, 16-bit size, right? No, I don't remember. Anyway, so it's very straightforward.
I think it's 32-bit now, but I don't, yeah, okay.
Anyway, it doesn't matter. It
does not matter.
The point is that we can look it up. That's the point.
Okay.
That it's well documented. And it was well documented in 1982, well before, well before it was a good idea to do it. And I think it's the gold standard, which we still have yet to follow very well, of sharing documentation and sharing ideas and being very clear about these formats.
So are you saying that you don't feel like modern day sort of, the modern day way of doing file formats and that sort of stuff does not adhere to this? I guess, are you perhaps talking about something like PSD, for example, where you look at the spec and it's like, what is this?
Oh, okay, PSD is a good example,
okay.
Right? It's not well documented,
yeah.
Great. But I'm also talking about your own formats.
Okay, so you're talking about like on a game. So you're making, you know, a Ratchet and Clank game or something like this, and you have some file formats that you're doing. You actually think, for example, that your team should document those internal only file formats, for example.
Yes.
Okay, so why?
Why should you document your file
format? Yes, internal. Why would you document an internal only file format?
I mean, it describes your data, right? And it's a, you know, and it's the source inputs to your system, and it's probably the most important thing that you're working with.
Okay.
You know, the most important set of things that you're working with. Everything else can be derived from that. If I can understand the source input data, then I can pretty much figure out what the rest of the system is doing or must do, right? So I'm pretty sure that if I took, you know, any arbitrary game out there and I said, this is a description of what the source data looks like, and I just released it to the hacker community,
yeah,
they could go to town on this game,
okay,
right? And because that's the most important information.
Okay.
And that's obvious that it's the most important information. Like, that's the thing that you would want to start with. And yet, we don't do a great job about documenting what is, you know, probably the most important information that we're working with.
And do you think that's something that needs to be done during the active development so that there is a document which actually evolves with changes to that data? Or are you saying more like when the game ships, part of the process of shipping should be to take the final state of the data and document that?
Well, I think it should be accurate. So however that works.
Whatever the way, so at the day that the thing ships, whatever the way is to make sure that the data description is the most accurate, that is the thing you would like to see happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some teams, for instance, doing it at the day it ships would be a really bad idea.
Okay. Because
that's the most stressful time for the team, and they're already overwhelmed, and they're already working extra hard. And to say, you know what, I know you are working on this sort of like 500 bugs on 20 different PCs and some guys and stuff. You know, I know you're working on that, but can you write some documentation on this file format?
Right. The slap goes the other direction at that point, right? It's like, wham!
So that's probably not going to fly for some teams, right?
Okay.
So it may be much better to do it, you know, incrementally as you go and as you change, and just make it part of the change process. But, you know, I do think we're talking about, you know, multiple different things. I think we're all talking about the internal formats, but we're also talking about the external things when we share, right?
Okay.
And making that interoperability more possible.
It does seem like there's been, I don't want to say a loss of that, but there's definitely, I guess, less of an external incentive for that now to some degree, too, because I guess it just, this is the first time I've ever thought about this, because I don't think anyone's ever said that to me before. So I'm kind of like going in my brain. So in the past, we saw things like, for example, Doom had a very well-documented file format so that people could mod it, and it led to, there's a complete understanding pretty much of everything that goes into that game or something like this. But as I guess we get more towards the Steam Workshop style of like there's just these tools that people use and nobody's ever really touching the data besides the programmers, I guess there's no longer much external pressure on a developer because they're, you know, maybe it's all integrated inside, so we maybe wouldn't see things like Doom so much anymore. I mean, is that a fair characterization perhaps of that?
Well, I think one of the things that we should consider is, you know, the sort of the historical aspect, right?
Yeah.
And you know how easy it is to archive and save things, right? I mean, we can certainly imagine it being much easier to save, an older game, much easier to save certainly an older game that's well documented, much easier to port it to a new platform and sort of keep it alive.
Yes.
The less information you have about it, the less, you know, the harder it is to save.
Yes.
And we're talking about, you know, once we get into sort of the last 10 years, basically, it's already a hard problem, right?
Yeah.
How to archive a PS3 game runs on a network on PSN, right, is already a really, really hard problem. And to make that even harder is, you know, pretty much just presumes that it's not important to archive the data. And you know we're going to lose a lot of that data. I don't know if that's important to everybody, and I'm undecided of whether or not it's important to me. in the scope of things.
But if it were important,
if it were important, definitely
the case that we're not really not set up for it, I suppose.
And there's something else I think that comes up in practice, right? When we're, you know, at some point somebody's going to say, hey, can you port this forward, right?
Yeah.
You know, can you take this, you know, assuming like, okay, Super Meat Boy, take for instance, right, what we're talking about. So in your speech, you know, you've it's not that long ago, right? But you know, would you guys consider it a classic at this point? Yes? More or less, right? Which means that in 10 years, somebody's probably going to think about it, remember it, and want to play it again, right? And maybe all this architecture that we currently presume is different, very, very different, right? And somebody's going to want to port it. And then somebody's going to ask, not you, but the mountains of people that work for you, to port it, right? And you're going to go, what the fuck, I don't even remember, you know, that was 10 years ago. I'm going to have to watch videos of myself talking about it to even remember what I was doing. And, you know, having the ability to go back and, you know, have that be well documented, at least in terms of what the formats were and what the data looks like, so that you could, in theory, you know, at least break it down and figure out, you know, what the cost is of pulling it forward, would be totally worthwhile. And I suspect very strongly that that will in fact happen. That at some future point, that this will happen on some architecture that's hard for us to imagine today, and that you will have completely forgotten what all the data looks like, right? So yes, I don't remember the question. Oh, so another completely random point.
Right, I have no insight into the list.
This is still the same point. We're still talking about SWF, right? So the one document I think everybody should read is the Tim Berners-Lee World Wide Web pitch document. I want to make a World Wide Web. This is the pitch. This is what I'm going to make, and it's very short. It's like a few pages long. Everyone should read this because what you will learn is. Pretty much everything that he set out to accomplish, all the problems that he set out to accomplish. Now imagine this worldwide, you know, this is before the web, so this is early 90s or whatever. And everything that he set out to accomplish, all these problems that he wanted to solve, he's literally solved none of them. None of them. You imagine how much the world has changed, right? How much the web has changed everything that we do and how we interact with each other, and all business and, you know, everything. And yet, fundamentally, we've solved none of these problems.
I'm very interested to see what they are now.
You know, which is really, you know, it's really about, it starts with, like, I can't find these documents that are important to me, you know, and it's just so complicated and I can't find the document. Okay, who has a problem finding information that, you know, is relevant to their work right now, today, right? That's still true. Yeah. It's still true that it's hard to find that document. It's still true that, you know, even if you have what he imagined was something, you know, very clearly something like a wiki, right? Yeah. Okay, how many people have wikis that survive the test of time? Like after 5 years, you can find everything. It's totally there, it's totally documented.
Well, okay, to be fair though to them, as soon as they finish figuring out how to turn these important documents into Justin Bieber songs, the web will work perfectly, right? Because you can always find and get those.
So. I'm not down on Justin Bieber.
Well,
fair
enough.
He's fine. I'm a huge pop fan. But yes.
Continue. It's a data transformation problem. We just have to take the things we can find and turn the things we can't find into that.
I think there is some legitimacy to that argument. And it's in terms of what you can associate, you know, information with. I think there's some legitimacy to that. But in terms of taking the lesson of, you know, you have, and I don't know what to take away from this. You've taken a problem of insurmountable scope. You know, I want to be able to get this. I want to be able to track down this information. I want to be able to communicate with people, and I want to be able to, in very specific things. Like I can't find the document that I want. I want a solution I want something that solves this for me, and which has sort of always been a problem in sort of all of human history.
Yes.
And say I have a solution for it, And it changes the world, and yet,
you still
can't find the document that you want. I find that fascinating, and I don't know what the lesson is, but it's super fascinating.
So yeah, like I guess, so you're basically saying, take a look at this pitch document. See the things he said he wanted to solve.
Yeah.
He hasn't managed to solve any of them, I guess, even though he created a whole bunch of solutions to other problems or whole new problems even.
That's basically what we've done, right?
Create more problems.
We've created a lot more problems. Super fascinating, interesting problems. Huge, hugely interesting problems.
And you're sitting over there listening to Tommy talk about importing an SWF file.
Yeah.
And that was what what you thought of.
Yeah. There's a connection, right? There's SWF format and reading the document and something to do with that document. And anyway, there you go.
All right. So I have some questions for you I want to ask.
Okay.
Is there anything else on the list?
Yeah, sure. But go ahead.
All right. Because I wanted to ask the things that I can only ask you, or at least out of the people that are at HandmadeCon. So, going back to putting documents aside for 1 second, because as we already said, you can't find them anyway. So it's largely academic.
Or you can't read them.
You can't read them, or we can't find them. Yeah. Either or. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, or to try to get some perspective on, because I opened this with a question that I had for you that I didn't know the answer to, that people often ask me, which was the scaling up, does that change OOP versus whatever, that sort of stuff. But then another question that I get asked often.
Oh, so let's go back to that question. So scaling up, right?
Yes.
Let's put the other one aside for a minute.
That's all right.
Just a minute. So scaling up. I talk to indie groups. Who's indie, considers themselves indie in the room?
Fair number.
Okay, yeah. That's a pretty good number. So sometimes I talk to indie groups. So now I'm talking to you guys,
right.
Indie group. And they'll talk to me about the engine that they're making or that they want to make. And they'll be asking questions. And often what I'll see is that they are doing it very similar to, say, what we would do. Or they're looking at Unity and they're doing something similar to Unity or Unreal or whatever. They're sort of copying.
You mean
those
make like looking at making sort of an editor thing that you put entities down like
yeah,
starting
or,
that
or at the runtime or the tools or whatever. And I have no problem with people making their own tools. Fundamentally I'm an engine programmer and that's kind of what I like to do. So I get it. And I don't have a problem with people doing that, and that's what you like to do. But what I think that people miss is the context in which they're working. You're working with you're working on a game, right? In your indie space, you're working by yourself or with a group of people or students, you're working with a group of students or whatever, and you're missing the context in which you're working. You're looking at what other people have done, and you're sort of just copying that model,
okay.
Right? And so you're looking at Unreal, you're looking at Unity, and you're saying, okay, they have actors and enemies and things, and I'm sort of copying that model because that's how you do it. And I think that in the same way that taking a physical model, mental model, and saying this must be right and everything else is wrong, this is also a poor approach to say, because Insomniac did it, or because Epic did it, or because whoever did it, that must be the right approach, so I'm just going to sort of copy that, is also wrong.
Okay.
Because it has nothing to do with your problem.
Okay.
It has to do with our problems, which are very, very different. And to talk about, to go back to your point, which is sort of what's the difference of scale.
Yes.
Right? The difference is huge. It's massive. So when you're talking about one game, or at least one game at a time, and you're talking about an indie team, it's a group of small people who communicate really on a deep level, right? You have 7 people or 10 people or 5 people or whoever that can just communicate together on a deep level. That totally changes the game. I was talking to one team recently and it was just sort of breaking down. They started out with the actors and components thing similar. And I'm just like, okay, why do you even have this? Like conceptually, they're like, these are the components I have. I'm like, forget all of this.
Okay.
What's your game? What are the problems you're actually trying to solve? And they would say something like, okay, well, we have ladders in our game.
All right.
Okay, cool. We can start with ladders. Why do you have ladders and what are they doing? But let's start with ladders. I'm saying the difference between what you're talking about building, sort of this general purpose editor where, a designer's going to spend time placing a ladder and setting, assigning it a ladder component and doing all that. I'm like, now imagine a different scenario by comparison. I know the context in which I'm making the game. You guys are like 7 people. I'm going to make an editor that understands that I use ladders.
There's a ladder button.
Right. There is a literal ladder button. And it shows me on the screen all the only the places that a ladder could possibly appear.
Right.
Right. And understands the constraints. I've defined the constraints under which a ladder can appear. So it's sort of ghosting in all the places that it could possibly appear. And I just click on one. That's right. The one. Ladder right. goes there. Yeah. That's like 3 seconds to put a ladder. I don't have to waste time like dragging some object in, and it's an arbitrary model that's attached to some arbitrary yeah. component, because I'm not making an arbitrary game. I'm making this game.
Yes.
And I'm making tools for this game. And that fact that you have that much more context means you can solve the problem that much better. Ignoring the context, or alternatively, if you want to look at it a different way, is trying to make it too generic.
Yes.
You're causing problems. You're making it slower. It's like you're intentionally making the problem harder by ignoring the context, by trying to make it too generic.
It's basically the analog of what you were talking about with code before. It's just like, don't introduce extra things in here yeah. if they were not actually relevant to solving the problem.
Right, and to say it has to be generic right. or it has to follow this other model is introducing this whole mental abstraction, this whole mental model into the problem that just didn't exist. And you just made yeah. it an order of magnitude harder.
It also doesn't seem clear why you would really want to go that route, because if you just want to end up with Unity or Unreal again, you could have just used them. Right,
well, for
like you should be trying to do something that you want to do that's
for sure, that's your advantage,
different.
I think, and that's yeah. Just your advantage as an indie in the space, right, is that you have that deep understanding of your context, and you can take advantage of it, and you can write things that are just... They cannot be used to make anything else.
Yes, yes.
But they just kick ass at this one thing, and that's awesome. And even at our scale, right, we can do that better than, say, a team that has to support, you know, millions of people
yes.
or, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. Like, we can do it better than that, but we still can't do it to the extent that one really small, because we do have multiple games in flight yeah. that all have slight differences, and we do have to be more, you know, support a wider range of stuff. So we can't even be as good as those smaller teams. So that's their advantage. Anyway,
that was excellent. I love the list.
Scaling. So anyway, back to your...
So my question is sort of a couple different questions, but it's sort of all the same basic idea, which is that, you know, when I got into the game industry, it was so long ago that it didn't look anything like it looks now, for example. So a lot of times, you know, especially because with the series, it's... You know, a lot of people who aren't in the game industry but might want to be getting in the game industry watch it or try to practice or do that stuff. And I get asked the question, like, what should I do if I actually want to pursue a career here? Like, what does that look like? And I get all kinds of questions that I simply can't answer. Should I go to college? What should I be practicing? What does my resume supposed to look like? How do I apply? All these sorts of things. So I was wondering, as someone who actually presumably has a little more insight into the process by which people come into the industry now, and two, as someone who presumably has spots they need to fill on occasion, and I would imagine has a bunch of things they wish were true about the people who were coming through the door, like, could you give me a little perspective on that so that when I get asked that question, I can say, well, I don't know, but Mike said this.
Right.
If it's too tough of a question,
no,
then we
I
can...
No, I mean, I have an opinion. I can certainly share. Right. I always have an opinion about everything. But to start with, I mean, I'll agree with your point that it's really hard for me to relate to
yes.
people who are getting into the games industry now as a concept. Like, I simply can't, I don't have that exact
yes.
experience that you're dealing with right now. I have nothing to relate to that.
Yeah.
You have this mountain of schools you could choose from. I'm like,
right.
I don't even know what that's like.
Yeah.
Dock yourself out.
Yeah.
You have the internet and
yes.
documentation and examples, and so yeah, it's a completely different playing field that I don't know. The best person to ask is somebody who just did it like 4 years ago.
I guess so.
Like,
yeah.
You know, that they're the best people to ask. But in terms of hiring, I can certainly give some
yes.
insight into what I look for. Over time, I've looked for things that correlate strongly with good hires. You know, and whether that's, you know, what school you're going to or your test score, because we do have a test.
We do give
a programming test. Or your test, you know, your responses on the test or your work history or whatever. You know, I've tried to look for things that correlate strongly with what I would consider good hires. And there's literally only one thing that I found that correlates, and everything else doesn't, and that's really, really, really hard, because it just doesn't. Like, if I said whether or not you pass our test well actually doesn't really correlate strongly with how good of a programmer you're going to be for us.
Why do you still give it?
Partially because there are bits in there that do tell me something.
Okay.
Right. So I do find it useful or insightful. Part of it is just fear. Like, what do I do if I don't have it? I don't have an alternative answer here.
Fair enough. Okay.
I am human at the end of the day, so yeah, fear. I don't have,
Always a strong motivator.
Yeah. The one thing that I have found that correlates is curiosity.
Curiosity.
Okay. That's literally the only thing. And curiosity to a point where it's insatiable, where I cannot, where it's undeniable. Like, if I'm talking to somebody and they aren't very curious, ultimately, it's obvious that they aren't very curious.
Interesting.
I'm going to ask questions and they're going to say, not only do I not know, but I don't care.
Okay.
Right? It's not important for me to know that, to do my job.
So
I haven't thought about it, right?
I see.
That's just a level of non-curiosity that just doesn't do well for working with the group that I work with, right? Working with my team. Now, on the flip side, somebody who's insatiably curious, right? Where it's just like everything, they may not have enough, you certainly don't have enough time to satisfy it all,
yes.
But you want to know, you're interested in knowing, right? You dig in and that sort of thing correlates strongly with being successful on our team. How does that help people who are, trying to find a job? I don't know.
Well, it kind of does in some sense,
curious,
too.
Be curious is certainly first on the list, but maybe demonstrate, demonstrable curiosity, right? Show me that you are you're curious about something deeply from, top to bottom. Even if it's just like one really great blog post where you've just dug into something deeply and you've just kept digging until you hit sand, right?
Yes,
and you're just like, this is everything that I could possibly learn about this in a month.
Yes.
Right? All the little tangents, all the little interesting bits. I just pulled every thread until I ran out of time, right, over a month or whatever. That's interesting, and that would be striking to me, and that's something that I would want to see. If it's just like, oh, here are three projects that I did, and, that's not even a little bit interesting to me, really. Especially if they're school projects, because it's like everybody did that.
They had
it's
to
like,
do them, right?
So whatever, it's an assignment. Big deal. Things that I don't care about, I don't really care about what school you went to, I don't really care about your grades, certainly don't care about what projects you did, I don't care about what classes you took, I don't care anything at all to do with your school, I don't actually even care if you passed or finished or...
Interesting.
I care about sort of what you've demonstrated, and mostly what you've demonstrated on your own will.
Yes.
That's what I'm interested in.
That's a fantastic answer. Thank you very much. I was like, all right, so I guess my secondary question maybe is not as relevant. That was kind of perfect. But I guess I'll just ask it anyway, which was, so, if there was something that I was going to tell people you should practice or know how to do, is there anything that you find lacking in terms of fundamentals, right? Like, it's like, hey, I wish that all the applicants we got, like, even the ones who were curious and, like, they have the right mentality for being on the engine team at Insomniac, that, like, that's all set, but I just wish they had done more of X or known more about Y would have been really helpful to us, right? So separate from maybe the hiring question, just more like, what do you want them to be prepped to do when they get there? Lots of Java programming, right? I'm guessing.
So again, the answer is not a very technically specific answer.
Okay.
The answer is practice.
Okay.
Most people do not know how to practice.
Okay.
And most people don't take it very seriously. And that, I think, is a massive problem a massive problem for them, really. A massive problem for you in your career if you don't know how to practice. Not taking it seriously is a big problem. You assume that, I'm learning what I need to know based on what I'm doing in my job. Well, that's not enough.
Okay.
It's your career, right? You need to take, you need to take that seriously as your own problem, and how do you learn and how do you practice and how do you advance your skills for your own career? This is your responsibility. Yes, you have a job and you're going to do that work. That's great, but separately, you have to deal with your career and where you're going and what you need to know, and you have to know how to do that well. And most people do not know how to practice well. You know, I talk to somebody and I'll say, you know, what do you practice every day? And they'll say, well, I don't really have time every day. I'm like, really? So aside from your family, like this is the most important, like this is the thing you're gonna spend your entire life doing. So you don't have time for the thing, like, do you forget to brush your teeth? Like you manage to do other things every day. Like you eat every day, you brush your teeth every day because it's important to you. You probably change your clothes every day. You might shower. You know, there are things you do every day because it's important, because it's part of who you are. And yet, you don't practice every day, right? The thing that you don't do it for your career. And so, the second thing I'll get is, I only have a little bit of time. And as a programmer, I really need to be able to sit down for hours in order to get into the mood to program. I'm like, okay, you're not a child. You know, this is, you know, as a professional and as an adult person, I think you should be able to organize your time so that, you know, you can get something out of 30 minutes if that's all you have. You know, you can absolutely do that. You can absolutely have a plan for how I'm going to use this 30 minutes and what I'm going to do, and that's better than doing nothing.
Yes.
It's just a sort of a series of excuses of why I don't practice, right? And why I don't know how to practice. And so not taking that seriously, I think, is a huge problem for people, not necessarily in terms of their contribution to a team, but for their own sake. Like, as a programmer, as an individual person with a career that you have to curate for yourself, like, this is the investment that you need to put in. Or you're just not going to be as good as you could possibly be, and, you know, that's presumably what you want, right? You want to be as good as you can be because this is your chosen career. So you need to spend that time. You need to figure out how to do it well.
So what's a good example of how someone might practice for 30 minutes if they, like, take this advice to heart and go, you know what, that is something I should be doing. What's a good starter project? A lot of times I tell people who are starting out in games, I'll be like, Asteroids is the one to make first when you're, like, learning, you know, how to make games because it's the simplest possible thing and blah, 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 right? So let's talk about practice, like you said it. What's the simplest way to get started practicing? What would you say would be something, if you had 30 minutes a day, you were going to start devoting to getting better at programming games?
Well, I mean, you could pick something like, say, let's say you were going to pick Asteroids, right?
Yeah.
Fine. My biggest advice would be, for a while, for at least if you're just starting to learn how to practice well, is to throw away everything you do after every practice. Do not have any kind of continuity.
Interesting.
So maybe you work on the same problem, but you are not allowed to keep anything that you did before.
I see.
So that you simply have to get better at it. You have to get faster.
You have to try a different way next time and see if it works better and that sort of thing.
Because if you keep it, it doesn't become practice, right? It becomes a project.
I see.
And it becomes a hobby at that point. And it's not about a hobby, it's about real practice. So just throw it away and then get better at it, right? So if it's about Asteroids, then ultimately maybe your practice is, how can you make it in 30 minutes? Like, what do you do on
Asteroids
the first day?
In 30 minutes.
You know, the first day you don't even get close. The second day you don't even get close.
Yeah.
Like, the 300th day, maybe you're pretty close.
Yeah.
If you'd be able to do it in 30 minutes because you've done it so many times. That's practice.
Okay.
And that's valuable, right? Maybe you're not practicing the right thing. You've gotten really good at building Asteroids in 30 minutes. But there's probably something valuable to be taken from that. But I mean, really, I think it's you know, I would say pick pretty much anything, right? Pick a project, an open source project, your own project, whatever, and just start picking it apart, right? You know, have a plan. How am I going to spend the first 2 minutes saying what am I going to do for 30 minutes? Have a plan.
Got it.
And if that's, I'm going to analyze this so I can gather more information, or I'm going to make this bit faster, or whatever, fine, do that. You know, you have a plan. Spend your 30 minutes doing that, and then stop. And then throw it all away. And then tomorrow, have a new plan. And that's, you know, it's a completely different kind of thing than a hobby or a project or a portfolio piece or your work. Or it's just about the value of the practice is the practice.
Is the practice.
So.
Well, I think we're just about out of time. So did you have any stuff you wanted to talk about? I don't want to
go back to my list.
Don't want to miss anything on the list, but also just if you wanted to say a few closing remarks just about, I guess I asked Tommy sort of if he had any stuff he wanted to mention that he's working on or stuff that he wanted to talk about just as sort of a closing remark. So if you've got any, I don't know what your days look like these days, but.
What am I working on? So there was a problem that I decided to dig into a little bit. We have something called a spatial DB, which is not really a database. It's just
spatial DB.
Yeah. Okay. And just a sort of our it's a sort of our mechanism to query things spatially in our engine. So we call it spatial DB. And I was interested in it and sort of seeing where the edges were and seeing if there was anything that we could do in terms of optimization.
Okay.
And so my approach was. I wanted to look into this more deeply. So I'm just sort of sharing what my approach to this was. And so I thought, okay, well, maybe, you know, as the game is playing, I can sort of just serialize it at certain points, and then I'm sort of sampling it, right? Serialize and then analyze it offline and say, where was this at this point? And, you know, so I could look deeply, more deeply into the data.
So periodically, you would just sort of say, at this, you know, every n seconds or something, I'm going to
just
stream out,
it, yeah.
what does the DB look like here?
Yeah.
And later I'll go gather them back up in a separate thing and start to see
what's
the
DB. Yeah, that was my original plan, right? Okay. And I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, well, one, it's not really DB in any kind of, it's an interface. And that format is fairly optimized and fairly complicated and changing. And I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm feeling a little lazy. So instead, I said, well, what I'm actually going to do is there's a very limited number of entry points into this.
Okay.
Into this this data, right? Very limited number of ways that you can change the data. So there's sort of like add something to the database or edit something or delete it. Really, that's pretty much the whole initialization function. So that's pretty much it. I'm like, fine. I'm just going to stream out, like a command buffer, I'm going to stream out all the entry points to this database so I can recreate it offline.
Yes.
Right? Now, whenever a programmer says, I'm going to do something else because I'm feeling lazy, usually it involves way more work than the original thing.
Yes.
Which is the true, absolutely, in this case. I streamed out all the entry point stuff, and I sort of, now I have a system that, I sort of a command buffer reading system where I just read it all back in and reconstruct the databases at any point. So now I can have a complete timeline. I'm playing the game, a complete timeline that I can scrub or whatever of everything that happened to the database at any point while I was playing. That's awesome, right? So I can do a lot of queries in here and see how it's going. Doing analysis and spinning out a bunch of data and analyzing tons of information that was super valuable. And then I said, you know what, there's a bunch of queries that are coming in, people asking in the game, I want to get stuff out of it. That's the whole point of the dig query, is the spatial database to do queries against it. So I'm like, I want to visualize the queries, like visually, like I want to see, what they look like. And our queries all come in as sort of a convex hull defined by planes.
Okay, so it comes in as a series of plane equations that bound some 3D space, like a polytope.
Right. Okay. So I'm like, okay, that's fine. I want to visualize that, so I'm going to visualize it as the hull, right? As polys. So we have a clipping function that will take a set of planes and clip it against a predefined hull. So
a
triangle, defined hull. And so I'm like, okay, that's cool. I'll just take a big cube and slice it up by.
Right, just make sure the cube is bigger than whatever the bounds of the planes are, and then I'll just let it carve everything that's not the elephant. We remove that marble and the elephant's left.
Right, yeah, okay. So it's fairly straightforward, which we use for various things. And I'm just gonna use this to sort of visualize the spatial data, right? It doesn't work in some cases.
Okay.
So I'm looking at it and I'm like, okay, well, there's these cases where it's just, I'm just basically getting garbage out of this, right? I want to visualize it. And it turns out that the problem is in that clipping routine.
Yeah.
Which we use in various places. But, the problem only showed up because, I have this huge set of data that I'm gathering.
Yeah.
And all these different queries, hundreds of thousands of queries over time and every variation on it, right? And I pretty much just have this massive test database now.
For the Polygon Clipper,
right. And just this gigantic test, and I can split it against, because I just have this, because I just have this sort of history of the data, I can just go back and forth and see exactly where it goes wrong. And there's not actually a slider, right? That's mentally sliding. But you know, so I went down this rabbit hole of like fix the Clipper.
Yeah, yeah. We've gotten to fix the Clipper from I'm going to take a look at the spatial database.
Right, but I mean, the thing about it is just looking at the data, right? The lesson for me here is, you know, I started out with something else, right? But it's just about visualizing the data, looking at it, and analyzing it. And while I did find out lots of interesting things about the spatial database, I did also discover things about a completely unrelated system that I didn't expect. Like I found surprises in just trying to visualize the data that also needed some, you know, attention. So just the sort of effort of visualizing and just the sort of effort of digging into the data, not only, and it's helpful to fix, like offline now I have this gigantic database I can test it against.
It's a perfect test suite.
Absolutely, my turnaround time is like, you know, less than a second to just test against this massive, you know, database of tests that are all real world scenarios, right, that I've just recorded and I can get as many as I want. It's certainly not reloading the game, the iteration, that kind of iteration time. It's just this like, and I can do it on my laptop, right? I can do it in Linux, right? And I like Linux tools, so I can do it there. So super easy to iterate on, and I have a much better result just because I'm looking at the data. And that's, for me, like this is the approach that I like to take to problems, the approach that I find to be useful. And it's always surprising, you know, there's always something that I hit that I didn't expect to hit just because I looked.
Yes, I feel like capture and visualize is kind of like the way most hard problems end up getting solved, and sometimes problems you don't even know that you had, because until you actually see the visualization, you don't actually realize, you know?
I think finding different ways of looking at the problem, like in terms of your, you know, your eyes, your ears, or whatever, looking at it, is an important part of what we do. Like, that's where we should be spending most of our time. And not in the code. Like, programmers think that their job is to write typing, like writing code, and that's really not it. Like, that should be less than 1% of your effort, right, is the typing part. Which is why I don't want to hear, like, I don't want to do this because it takes too long to type. Like, really? Fucking nobody ever didn't ship a game because it took too long to type.
Well, if you get enough monkeys and enough typewriters, right? Well, I think that's all the time we have. Thank you so much for the conversation. It's been awesome.
All right.
And that was, thank you.